connecting to the internet.
Internet.
Networking software.
World Wide Web for
the computer today.
Computer.
NetSurfer Pro.
So that leads us into level 4, Bangkok of Thailand fame.
Club 47.
Yeah, Club 27.
But isn't it?
No, it's Club 27 because the whole thing is it's the 27 Club.
So, okay, yeah. So I knew it's about the 27 Club.
I think that there's a mission story called Club 47.
It.
Yeah.
Yeah. So the 27 Club is a thing about artists, especially musicians, who die at the age 27. Kurt Cobain, Jim Morrison, Jimi Hendrix, Janis Joplin. I only know these because of the manga The Shiori Experience.
Which is like, what if people dying at 27 gave you a stand that was them?
And then they started a band.
Yeah.
I'm not joking. That's the fucking premise of the manga. It's got Jimi Hendrix.
Let me just tack up Jimi Hendrix and that manga onto the conspiracy board real quick. You go ahead and introduce Bangkok.
That's also why the Fall Out Boy song 27 is called that, because it was written when Pete Wentz was 27 and
God damn it,
I have to put stressing Pete, about that.
I have to put Pete Wentz on the thing too. God
he sure went somewhere from whence he came. So it's called Club 27 because it is the 27th birthday. It is the 28th
yes,
birthday.
It's the 27th birthday.
It's the 27th birthday of one Jordan Cross.
Jordan Cross is an asshole.
He's a piece of shit. He is the lead singer and frontman of a band called The Clash.
Who I am, just so you know, I am going to misspeak and say The Clash multiple times in this recording, I assure you. And by this recording, I mean this conspiracy.
Yeah, it's nothing to do with The Clash. This is a different band entirely.
It's a significantly better, sorry, significantly worse band than The Clash.
Yeah. A lot of people compare Jordan Cross to fucking
Jared Leto?
Jared Leto, yeah. Yes. His name escaped me for a moment. And I kind of get it. The problem is that people actually, like, I guess people liked 30 Seconds to Mars for a little bit. yeah, but like,
He is like visually designed after Jared Leto, so
yeah.
There is smoke there,
and he is problematic.
Yeah,
it's just he did not or has not made his career turn to acting. He is still, for what it's worth, a musician.
Not a particularly good one at that either. I'm going to bring up one of his songs later, because of course there's an entire song that they created for there's an entire fictional song that they created for this fictional band, in the same way that there's a whole bunch of fictional brands for this fictional world.
Yeah.
Love this game. Anyway.
So he is in Bangkok because I believe his dad rented out the like penthouse suite at the Himipan Hotel.
Yes.
For his birthday party. It's a huge birthday. They've also set up a recording studio there.
Specifically, what ended up happening is that Jordan Cross's girlfriend, Hannah Highmore, right?
Yeah.
She died tragically and suddenly and under mysterious circumstances. Spoiler, she was killed by Jordan.
She fell off of Jordan's balcony.
Yes.
Who could have seen that coming? What an accident.
And he got his father, who owns like a gigantic media corporation. I believe Thomas Cross is basically like a Rupert Murdoch style.
Yeah.
He got his father to bail him out, basically, and like, you know, do a whole marketing campaign and basically he did a whole bunch of like rewriting such that by the end, he was this, like, you know, tragic victim put upon by this shrieking harpy, and she was, you know, this terrible, like, horrible partner to him. It's very, in a post, like, Johnny Depp, Amber Heard world, it's very thematically resonant, let's say.
Some of it reminds me of the way Britney Spears was depicted.
Yeah, yeah. It's almost certainly inspired by, like, yeah, Britney Spears or, like, Amanda Bynes, like, a lot of those actresses.
Yeah, because Hannah Highmore was a starlet for all intents and purposes.
Yeah.
And her parents, the Highmore family, are the people that contracted the ICA.
Yes.
Because they think, which is actually the truth, that Jordan killed Hannah.
Yes.
By the way, a big part of this level is Jordan Cross's daddy issues.
Yeah.
We had mommy issues. Now it's only fair we have the daddy issues one. Jordan Cross, part of the backstory is that The Clash was like a thing he made by himself to get out of his dad's shadow.
Yeah.
And he had mostly cut contact until he killed Hannah. And he is forced to ask daddy for help. And he hates that fact. And he also especially hates the fact that he pretty much reads everything to be his dad fucking with him.
Yeah.
There's a birthday cake and Jordan Cross is vegan and you can poison his vegan birthday cake and it's a special thing. But like, there's like an aspect of that. He gets mad because his dad is fucking with him. Yeah. I think like somebody pops out of the cake or something and he's like, no, my dad put you up to this, didn't he?
Nobody pops out of the cake, but his Dexie Barrett, his manager, recurring character, who's also lovely. Dexie does like have a conversation with him after where he's
that's
like,
right.
No, this is just this is just him saying, no matter where you go, I'm going to be in charge.
That's right. And then like the thing he doesn't know at first, though, is that the lawyer who helped get him off in the trial about Hannah is at the hotel.
Yes, he got off at the trial. Holy
come
shit.
On. Yeah. So, is Ken Morgan from the Morgan, Yates & Cohn law firm.
Which is so fucking good that, yeah, one of the fourth targets that you do is the named lawyer of the major law firm.
Yeah, this law firm will reappear. This is the end of the Avengers thing.
Yeah.
Morgan, Yates & Cohn will reappear. Ken Morgan's there because Dexie Barrett has incriminating evidence that she needs to give to Ken Morgan so it can be destroyed.
Yeah.
I think also there's some amount of like she is using it as leverage for her own career. Dexie is a scheming character in her own right who is always on the periphery of things but never directly involved.
I will say we like Dexie Barrett. Dexie is scheming, but like I think she's allowed to be scheming in this particular business.
Now, there is some interesting bits regarding that. So Dexie has a recording of the night where the murder happened. What happened is that Jordan Cross got into an argument with Hannah and in a bit of uncontrolled rage killed her by pushing her off a balcony. You can plug that audio recording into like the MP3 player in Jordan Cross's bedroom and he'll hear it.
And he'll run in and be like, oh, fuck, who could have done this?
And he realizes it was Dexie, and he pushes Dexie out the fucking window.
Yeah, if you don't stop him. But, like, yeah, it's...
And he calls his dad, and he's like, Dad, I did it again.
Also, if you don't allow that to happen, you can sit down on a chair behind him, and, like, he'll freak out. And eventually he will turn around and see you.
Yeah.
And it's one of the more, like, it's one of the greatest moments because there's a lot of, as we've said, there's a lot of moments of 47 talking to the target. Rarely does 47 get to talk to the target with them being fully aware that he is there to kill them. And so him just being this, you know, this Sigma male as Jordan's like, please, I'll pay you. And he's like, we're far past that.
It gives me like Anton Chigurh vibes to an extent of just like you're sitting there waiting for him to open the door.
Yeah.
It's a great bit. But also there's a lot of, well, not a lot. There's a few ways you can get Jordan to actually see Ken Morgan. They are on not only opposite ends of the map, like on one axis or two axis, but all three axes, they are as far apart as possible. Jordan is in the top floor of the left spire, and Ken is on the bottom floor of the right spire.
Yeah, he is waiting for room service to get his room ready for him to go to the top floor of the right spire as well.
Yeah. Now, there is a whole process where you can dress up as hotel staff, lead Ken Morgan to his room, give him a tour of it.
I want to talk about this.
Okay.
This mission story is so good. So this mission story is you can check into your own hotel room first and foremost. It's one of the first things you can do is you can just walk up to the teller and say, checking in for Tobias Reaper. Huh, that's interesting he has the name as of ride operator Bane's partner. That's very cool. Anyway. So
we're in the episode. You don't have to lampshade it.
Oh, yeah. Sorry. Of course.
We typically drop the premise of the cold open and the sort of bookending of the narrative.
But
when we're
how
in
are
the
we
actual
supposed
episode.
To stretch our improv chops? How are we supposed to get the people who are listening to know we're funny? So, like you can check in to your room. And then you can call room service. You get one of the best lines, which is 47 going, there's a problem with the toilet. Take care of it. And you get two people from room service. They go to check on whatever problem you say. There's a couple different ones you can do. You knock both of them out. One of them has a disguise for you.
The other one's a woman.
Yeah. So you unfortunately can't wear her clothes.
They need to make Hitman, but you can also wear the woman's outfits because it's 2026 and gender equality is the new rage.
I have some good news about Blood Money. There is a couple of sections in Blood Money where you can dress up as a woman, and I think they actually respect, I think in Blood Money, the more problematic video game, they actually are like, this will only take a second, ma'am.
Holy
Which
shit.
Is kind of funny. Like, that's kind of great. Based in gender. Anyway,
this is where stacking the Double Fine game got it right.
So
you ever play stacking? It's like Hitman but with dolls. Okay.
The great part about this is you become the Karen to tell a random working class person to fix your problem for you. You put on the working class person outfit. You go and get Ken and be like, sir, please follow me. Your room is finally ready. And you go up. His room isn't ready. His room was actually trashed by the, like, other members of the class. Like, all the members of the class are, you know, having the run of it, and the other guests are even complaining because they're all being rowdy fucking children. Rowdy man children, let's be clear.
And women children.
Or she, or they. So you bring Ken up to his room, and he brings you around the perimeter with his guard. He has a personal guard following him. He brings you around the perimeter and is like, you missed a spot. And so you like clean up an area, and he's like, the table's dirty. And at the very end, he then chews you out. And I don't know if he dismisses his guard or if his guard just like walks away and you get a moment to kill him. But yeah, then he becomes the Karen chewing you out for, you know, fucking up his room, at which point you can then stab him. Which, I love this mission story. This, one of the reasons that I love this game, and I think this game actively has good politics, is that the gameplay reinforces it.
Yeah.
Like, the gameplay of this, because this is one of the most, like, immediately present mission stories that you can get, and the fact that it is kind of completely isolated from Jordan means that if you want to get Ken out of the way, it's kind of the one you'll end up doing first. This is like such a perfect 1-2 punch of like you 47 awkwardly trying to be the person who's like, solve my problem. And then 47 much more comfortably in the role of just doing the work, getting, his ass handed to him by a customer, is like so incredible. Such good writing and like such good like showing theme through gameplay. Like, absolute cinema. No notes.
Yeah. I also want to note that,
But I just said no notes. Sorry.
I also want to add on that, like, when we talked about Paris, I mentioned this philosophy that IO has where they want players to be able to do the cool, fancy thing.
Yeah.
Checking into this, like, tropical exotic hotel and getting to go to a hotel room, that is the cool thing. Being able to just check into the hotel is the fun fantasy you can do in this level that you can't do in real life because you're poor. You fucking poor person. Also, though, I feel like the call room service, get the disguise, is like another trope to this sort of international thriller thing.
Yeah.
And so it's very fitting that that is one of the, like, first things that are easy to do. Getting Ken to this hotel room is important for a few reasons. For one thing, it is cool to have the parallel of the two penthouses on opposite sides of the hotel containing the two targets. But by putting them into lockdown, they will meet by running into each other in the above like the atrium.
Yeah.
Yeah, there's like a rooftop area over the atrium in the center that you can get them to at the same time. And then Jordan will be like, why are you here? Oh, yeah. My dad put you up to this. And I think there's a way for Jordan to kill Ken this way.
Yes, yes. So if you allow that little mission story, it's not a mission story exactly.
Yeah.
If you allow that to play out, because another way you can do this is there's a fumigator who needs to fumigate the like Emperor's suite.
Yeah.
And you can actually also use that to knock out everybody in the atrium by like rerouting the vents. I believe that's what the mission story gets
you to
do.
In the atrium or the suite?
Or it's the lobby.
Okay.
So you can do that. That's what the mission story wants you to do. If you do that and then get Jordan down to the ground floor and then get Ken and start going like, this way for your room, they will also meet and go up to Ken's room. When they meet, Ken taunts Jordan in front of a window, bad idea. And when, you know, Ken is like, I'm here because your father hates you. Fuck you. I hate you. Jordan pushes him out the window.
I'm gonna push you.
And then once again calls Dad to go, Dad, it happened again.
Yeah.
At which point you can now push Jordan out of the window as well, which is, so good.
The fact that you can so easily make Jordan kill other people is kind of wild.
Yeah.
Yeah. There's some interesting bits to that. Also, just like, Ken is in a very wide open area for most of his main routine. There's like the outdoor patio area that kind of wraps around, and there's a few dividers that are also kind of flimsy and I think have weird sightline bugs in some of the versions. Other than that, it's hard to like isolate him. There is a chandelier you can drop on him. He like tastes some of the sushi in the hotel bar and you can poison it.
Yeah.
But otherwise, you don't get a lot of chances to truly isolate him.
Jordan is weirdly one of the easier ones to take care of in this level. Now, to talk about the level itself as well as a stealth game level, Bangkok is probably one of my lesser favorites.
Yeah.
Here's the main thing. Bangkok is a puzzle box level. I don't think this is a term used by anyone else.
Correct.
This is just a little term I've come up with to describe it. It's like sandbox and puzzle box. You either have wide open areas with a bunch of little, you know, like scenes that you can go to, or a puzzle box, which is like a much more closed in area that has routes, but playing with those routes is like the way that you do it. Bangkok is a puzzle box that sucks.
It's closer to what they call a fortress.
Okay. It's the annoying thing is the cameras are just sort of universally difficult to get to. They're like on the second level in like a closed off area that is a key card that you're not going to have access to. You need a guard disguise to go in there or to at least stay in there. It's just sort of annoying. The cameras themselves are at least like inconvenient enough spots, but like that is an issue. There's the fact that like you're going to have to go upstairs to kill the people at some point, and so there's a lot of linearity, and even the non-linearity that they have, the like, you know, climbing pipes and stuff, a lot of the pipes that you can climb, like there's just not a lot of them, and the ones that you end up in are also sort of like one of them brings you to a decently close room where the class is, but it has a guy there and you can choke out the guy, but there's nowhere to hide him. One of the mission stories requires you to knock out a guy to grab a letter to like hand to Ken Morgan or like leave at the desk or something. And there's nowhere to hide him.
Yeah.
You can make him go to the restroom, but you can't hide him afterwards. So he will eventually get spotted. Yeah, like
it's really awkward is kind of how I would put it to an extent.
Yeah.
Definitely claustrophobic. Also, like, there's a lot of random enforcers where if you dress up as like a band staff member or a hotel cleaner, if you try to then go into Jordan's like king suite, there's just people that will see you. So like that part's really awkward. Just a lot of people in a very enclosed space, really.
Yeah.
There's also like three Frisk checkpoints on the way up there.
Yeah. Now, one thing I do have to shout out is one thing I absolutely love. There are notes around the level from the manager of the hotel, and they're all literally like, make sure that you bring this food to the kitchen. Anyone who doesn't will be fired. Make sure that you fold the laundry neatly. Anyone who fails will be fired. And when you are wearing a disguise that is a disguise that works at the hotel, She is a universal enforcer for it.
Yeah.
She knows all the people who work for her. That's so good. That is such incredible characterization. Because she's also like a roaming NPC, basically. Mm-hmm.
She inspects everything. So there is a very fun and notable mission story in this where there is a famous drummer named De Silva.
Yeah.
Nobody knows what he looks like.
Abel De Silva.
Abel De Silva. Nobody knows what he looks like. So luckily he is a bald white guy, so there's that going for it. But you can steal his clothes, dress up as him, and you can go up to perform with the class. The problem is they don't have a working microphone. Or no, I think it's just that there is a broken microphone in like the level somewhere in like the post office room.
One of
the mail room.
One of the things you can do is there's like a specific brand of microphone known for if you charge it too much, it will kill you. But it also has, you know, such a specific sound that like somebody has ordered it for it. And so you can replace it and then overcharge it and kill him that way.
And you can force him to perform on it by going up there for this song.
Yeah.
Now, what is great about it is in a later level, Abel De Silva reappears.
Yes.
And somebody says like, oh, but you know, you were so great on that last class record, the one they released after Jordan Cross died. And he doesn't remember recording it. Meaning that this is a canon kill.
Yeah. It's pretty implied that this is the canon route for killing Jordan, is pushing him off of the roof. So after you do the drum, Jordan's like, holy shit, you were so good at the drums. And he like brings you to the roof and he's like, hey man, I'm thinking of going solo. This class business, you should come with me. And then you can push him off the roof in the same way that he pushed his girlfriend off the roof.
Yeah.
So yeah, that is like lovely. I don't know if Abel De Silva himself shows up, but I do know that what's her name? She is the other one.
She's like the bassist.
Yeah, she and Dexy Barrett show up in another level later, much later, I believe. And I don't know if that's the conversation, but I do know there is an earlier conversation with her where she mentions like she paired up with Abel. And she's the one to say, yeah, he apparently doesn't even,
maybe that's what it is. Yeah. I do want to mention, before we move to the next level, that I really like the visuals of the Himapan.
Yes.
I am a sucker for this sort of, like, tropical sort of thing. When we talked about Tony Hawk's Underground, I mentioned how much I liked the Hawaii level for just existing in.
Yeah.
This is, like, the same thing. The atrium, the lobby, is like a greenhouse with a whole bunch of trees and shit. It's funny because it reminds me of something in the St. Louis Zoo.
Yeah.
They have the two historic, or they have the historical buildings, the reptile house, the monkey or the primate house, and the bird house. And all of those have a similar thing where it's like big open atrium in the center with a skylight and a whole lot of plants in the middle to create sort of an indoor garden, almost like a greenhouse effect.
Yeah.
So they have that going for it. Behind the hotel, there is a decently shaded and plant-filled area. There's like a banana truck or something there.
One of the best displays of opulence is on both the Emperor's Suite and the Queen's Suite. They have an indoor outdoor garden.
Yep.
Now, what I'm saying to you,
I fucking love the indoor outdoor garden.
It's so good. They're basically, imagine a donut. Imagine a Taurus.
Imagine a donut.
So like,
and inside the donut is a hole.
The hole doesn't have a roof and it is this beautifully curated garden. And the like,
but there's also the door connecting that to like another part of the suite has its own like sort of rock water garden area with like a little shrine.
Yeah. This little like temple area.
Yeah. I love it. I love it. I want to go there.
Yeah, I want to exist in this room in real life. Also, last note before we do move on, the like high visibility disguise for this one is a stalker.
Yeah,
like the I believe it's the bassist that we mentioned. I wish I remembered her name. She has a stalker who is in the Queen's Suite in kind of like a off the beaten path area upstairs. And so if you choke him out, you can steal his disguise and it is a high visibility disguise to most people.
Yeah.
Which is
also
funny.
There's a very cute little library sort of lounge study area. on under the Queen Suite, kind of right above the restaurant.
Yeah, yeah.
It's the environments are great. I just kind of wish the rest of the level was...
It is a wonderful level and a wonderful area. It is one of the lesser stealth game levels, in my opinion.
Yeah.
A lot of these are like, even when we are negative on them, this level is better than anything from like the first three Hitman games.
I need
to
be clear. This whole game is in my top five video games of all time. So when I have qualms with it, it is minor, ultimately.
It is an asterisk. Take it with a grain of salt. So, we get to...
Moving on from Bangkok, this is where the Shadow Client stuff really comes about. I think this is when the ICA realizes they're being played.
Yes, so it turns out that Thomas Cross, the father, was lured out by his son's death to be killed himself, and like all of his accounts were stripped afterwards. So Diana, like, meets with 47 in an airport and is like, there's a conspiracy. And he's like, what? We haven't done conspiracies since the last game.
Are you to tell me that somebody has been hiring us multiple times to do multiple contracts?
Wait, you mean these contracts weren't entirely ethical? What the fuck?
Yeah. So they have tracked the tracing of the funds from Thomas Cross's accounts to a ranch in Colorado.
Yeah. So Colorado.
So, yeah.
Colorado is a gun-filled, crime-ridden hellscape that sucks, and I hate it. Oh, hang on. Sorry. I mixed up my notes with the Wikipedia article for Colorado.
yeah. I was figuring I was going to be like, and then they put a level in there.
Yeah, of course.
So,
okay. Colorado. Once again, I'd like to put that in the asterisk. We're probably going to be more negative on Colorado than a lot of the other levels. It is the, like, least liked level, and it is for good reason. Once again, this is one where they did learn a lot of pretty good lessons from Colorado, but we'll get into it. The main thing is that there are four fucking targets. There should have been three fucking targets.
Yeah. I think my main thing with Colorado is that we are from the Midwest.
Yeah.
And while we are not from a strictly rural area, we are in proximity to farms that you can get to and pick apples from, like, a 40-minute drive, 30-minute drive. And so the stuff that is in this level, which is an apricot orchard and not an apple orchard, but similar thing.
Yeah.
The stuff that are in this level is fairly, like, not common, but kind of common from where we're from. And so, like, whereas stuff like Bangkok and Sapienza, we've sort of talked about the extravagance and the opulence. This level does not have opulence. It does not have extravagance. It has literal cow shit.
Yeah.
And mud puddles and mud pools.
Even compared to, like, there are other, like, levels set in U.S. state cities in other games, in, like, some of the other games, but even compared to them, Colorado is, like, one of the less, like, opulent, less, you know, luxurious areas that you can be in.
It's funny because this feels like the American version of how we describe Marrakesh.
Yeah.
But yeah. Also, like, that at least had the consulate to be this fancy, big ol', cool ol', modern ol' fantasy sort of place. Fantasy in the sense that it's a fantasy to exist there.
Yeah.
But, like, I've been to houses in buildings like the main farmhouse in this level. I've smelled that peeling linoleum floors.
Yeah.
Or laminate floors, whatever it's called. Dude, it smells bad. It's dusty and there's, like, silverfish everywhere. I know what this place smells like, which I cannot say for Bangkok.
Yeah. No, I do think that is also deeply interesting from a, like, I'm going to say reverse tourism angle because we're from the U.S. But, like, you know, if you're not from the U.S., this is not, if you're not from the U.S., this is also not necessarily the first thing you would probably think of when you're thinking U.S. You would probably think one of the coastal cities. You might think, you know, Texas or Florida. But, like, you know, Colorado, random estate in the middle of a wide open field that, you know, you farm stuff on, probably not the first thing you're going to think of. So I do think that that is an aspect where, like, thematically and from that angle, it is lesser to us, but only to us in that angle.
Yeah. I will say, they got it fucking on point.
Yeah.
So this is a farm orchard, like we said, and it has a lot of different farm buildings. It has a main stable area. It has sort of a mechanics area, like a garage. It has the orchard itself and the farmhouse. Behind the farmhouse is like a very typical backyard with like a beat up swing set, some like plastic Fisher House playhouse type shit. Like, it's so shockingly perfect to like, I know what those things are. It's like, it's incredible how tactile of a feeling and sensation it gives me. Of like, I recognize this from my childhood and from seeing it in backyards that I drive by on my way to McDonald's.
I did live in a house somewhat similar to this. I bounced between St. Louis and rural Illinois growing up. Like, rural Illinois in the sense that the closest major city was Mount Vernon. If you've never heard of Mount Vernon, exactly. And this is, like, very much like you said, this makes me think of my grandma's home. Of, like, one house that's reasonably big in the middle of farmland and a field that, as far as, you know, compared to the urban, like, centers that I'm used to, you could describe as nothing. Like,
the only thing it's missing is wasps' nests.
God, yeah. Oh, too many fucking wasp nests.
Yeah. So yeah, I think like the familiarity kind of ends up making it less interesting of a level in some regards, but it does more than make up for that in the story and narrative.
Yes.
Because you kind of have five targets in a way.
Yeah.
So there's four people, but then there's also some secret area that you have to find to get evidence on the Shadow Client.
So for context, yeah, I think in the first episode we mentioned Eric Soders as like the like training guy at the ICA who was hesitant to bring 47 in. This level, it should be noted that this level was kind of a rush job. Soders like kind of pressured the ICA to be like, hey, you know, this Shadow Client, we need to strike back at him to send a message that we are not for sale. We're not for sale multiple times. We don't play politics. And so, like, the crux of the mission is that this is, like, one of the more questionably ethical, quote-unquote, levels. It is still, like, I don't even think that we've mentioned, it's a fucking compound that's like a Waco compound.
Okay,
everybody
yeah.
is fucking
we'll get
armed.
To, we'll
yeah.
get to that.
But like, it's still one of the most interesting thematically from that angle of like, Diana is literally like, I'm not, you know, I don't think that we should have done this as quickly, but the ICA board has approved it. So let's see what we can find out.
So yeah, the real life inspiration for the level is very clearly like, Waco, the Bundy Ranch, the Manson Ranch.
Yeah.
Like, there are instances of these sorts of rural, or semi-rural in the case of the Manson, ranches being turned into sort of compounds. Though Waco, I believe, was sort of unintentional in this complicated. But, like, essentially this idea of, like, this place, it's sort of a sovereign citizen vibe.
Yeah.
Now, I have sort of complicated feelings because the targets are extremely multiracial.
Yeah.
And it feels weird. So, okay, going over the targets, let's start from the top. Sean Rose is the leader of this militia. He is a bomber for hire. He makes bombs, and he is interesting because they describe him as like a left-wing anarchist.
Yeah, he's like an eco-terrorist, and apparently, like, during a bomb that he put up that was supposed to just, you know, kill a refinery or something like that, ended up that, like, people died, including children, that kind of broke him a little bit.
Yeah, but, like, the thing is, he does just sell his bombs to whoever has money, and it really makes it complicated, because, like, you know, you hear left-wing anarchist, and I'm sure a lot of our listeners are going to be like, oh, hell yeah.
Yeah, based.
But, like, he does not really maintain the standards he claims he has.
Yeah, it's like the whole line of it being like, you know, noted left-wing terrorist Sean Rose, he kind of doesn't have a specific ideology expressed by it. And I think that's awesome because, like, you know, GNN describes him as the left-wing terrorist because Well, he's the big anti-authority terrorist that people can name in this universe.
Yeah. So next up is Ezra Berg, who is a Dead by Daylight character.
I keep calling him Ezra Klein.
So Ezra Berg is like Leatherface. He has like a mask he wears, and
he's a torture freak.
He's got a shack.
He uses chemicals to make people tell the truth. Like, he's not like his whole thing is, yeah, he's a torture freak, but he doesn't, you know, zap you. He just like makes you hallucinate, and he tries to be like, oh, I'm the big scary guy.
He has like an FBI agent who is infiltrating the compound in the basement of the farmhouse, locked up in a cell.
Yeah. And also he, oh God, I, specific point. He is an ex-Mossad operative,
yeah,
by the way.
Yeah, he's the ex-Mossad operative you mentioned.
Remember how Dahlia Margolis was an ex-Mossad operative? He's the second one.
Yeah.
The two of them are like a fucking information pervert and a torture freak.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Ezra Berg is, he feels like they were trying to reference, like, horror movies.
Yeah.
And he feels kind of out of place in some regards. Like, yeah, they do have a torture guy in the militia, but he feels more like they're trying to do a different genre than spy thriller. Because, like, the way he's presented, he has, like, a plaid flannel shirt on, doesn't he?
Yeah, yeah.
Like, he is more of a Jason or a Leatherface than he is a, you know, I will kill you, Mr. Bond, but although, I will make you talk.
It is also kind of worth noting, much like Klaus Strandberg, he is also, like, notably very polite and, like, you know, always very amicable when he talks with people.
Very polite villains, you say. You know, I was going to compare this to Scarecrow, but, you know, it sounds like me.
Yeah, he does have a mask, and I don't think that people cared who he was before that point.
No one cared who I was before I put on the mask, and very few people cared afterwards. It's kind of depressing.
I think more people cared when you started working at Six Flags. Oh yeah, that's still a sore subject. I'm so sorry.
So, next target is Maya Parvati, who is a former pirate.
Yeah, like, of the Tamil Tigers.
She used to work with a guy named the Maelstrom, who is this, like, famous, mysterious pirate. Keep that in mind. Yeah, Maya Parvati is a badass. She's a badass. I think she only has one arm?
Yes.
She's, like, biking?
This is one of the coolest fucking things. She has one arm. The person, like, she lost it on a excursion. One of the people who is a guard at the compound is the person who threw the like grenade that took off her arm. And he describes that like, yeah, he used to be on the other side and then he joined the militia. And he goes like, yeah, first day I saw her, I met her and I realized who it was. She looked at me and you know what she said? Good aim. Like, yeah, I fucking love her so much. She's so good.
And then the last person is one of the most, I think this is agreed upon by the community to be the most sympathetic villain.
Yeah.
This is Penelope Graves, who used to work for Interpol, but she found corruption in like the higher ups of the UN and was silenced and kept down for it.
Yeah.
So she joined the militia, hoping that she could actually bring that to justice. She ends up essentially being more like, she has more allegiance for the Shadow Client than she does for Sean Rose.
Yeah, yeah.
It feels really bad because, like, for the most part, yeah, she has like a gang of hacker boys, but like, she is probably the most respectful one and the one who is the most pursuant of justice in like good positive social change.
Her particular mission story, the ones who aren't Sean Rose only get like one specific mission story, which is one of the weaknesses, but
Parvati has a few.
She has a couple of different things, but there's only like one specific one that you're directed to.
Yeah,
but her mission story is that Sean doesn't really trust her. Sean wants to test her by like having a guy with a fake badge come up and be like, you know, ads, blah, 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 you know, you're going to give us information. If you do that, if you grab the badge and then do that with her, she like dismisses her guards and then she talks to herself and she's like, oh God, how did they find me? Like, you know, I made sure to delete all my footprints. I had my guy, you know, take me out of all the databases. She's 100% with the cause. And so like, yeah, she is a true believer. And of the three, like, Parvati is probably second most immediately sympathetic of the group, but she is also leading the, you know, she is leading the combat. She is training her men. She's kind of a hard ass. Like, Graves really is like just a very nice person who is trying her best to understand Sean for, you know, a what she sees at the very least as a positive change.
Yeah. I also think she is one of the least interesting to, like, deal with in the level.
Yes.
Because Ezra has some mobility in a lot of set pieces. Parvati moves through, like, most of the goddamn ranch.
Yeah.
She has, like, and she has a whole bunch of set pieces. There's, like, a practice range that has machines you can fuck with.
Yeah.
All these different, like, farming equipment that are super dangerous. She's usually the one you can affect with them. And then Rose is just like an interesting character who also has some good set pieces and mission stories. But Graves kind of just has like a few rooms in the house and I think a little bit outside the house.
She has like a greenhouse that acts as her outdoor office.
But she doesn't have much.
If this level was completely redone, I feel like her and Parvati probably should have been truncated to one character. And I kind of hate saying, like, just take the two female characters and make them one five head. But, like, Ezra feels flavorful and hateable in a way that's, like, very immediately apparent and kind of fun. Sean is sympathetic and interesting. The two of them are kind of, like, the two half characters in my mind. And I guess, like, Ezra is another half character, but he is, like, much like Zaydan, he is one where I look at it and go, like, does he need to be more complex? He can just be a torture freak and, like, that's his whole deal.
So, like, Sean moves through the house and also, like, a good amount of the house is dedicated to the hacker team.
Yeah.
So it feels like almost Sean could have just doubled as the information guy.
Yeah, exactly.
I don't know. Graves' position is weird, especially because there's a character who becomes an ally in a later game that kind of feels like Graves again.
Yeah.
I wanted to note that the thing that makes this level feel weird is that, at least nowadays, the idea of a militia ranch is so heavily tied to neo-Nazis.
Yeah, to right-wing terrorism, and basically.
And having, like, this, I don't know exactly what nationality Maya is, but...
Maya Parvati is... Oh, I did look this up, and now I can't remember either. I remember thinking that she was from Ambrose. Or not Ambrose. I remember thinking that she was Indian initially, because she worked with the Maelstrom.
Let's see, I'm looking it up.
Yeah.
Sri Lanka. Oh. So yeah, you have this person from Sri Lanka... And then, I don't even know what Ezra Berg is, but he used to be Israeli. A Mossad operative. Yeah.
Yeah.
So, like, you have this sort of multicultural militia, and it works well enough for what they're doing, but it feels like it doesn't hit as hard as it would have been if they were all white. And it's kind of stupid to say that, but, like...
I am actually going to disagree with this.
Interesting.
Point. I love Freedom Fighters. The name of the mission is Freedom Fighters. I love Freedom Fighters kind of... explicitly because it has four different targets who are very disparate, and all of it coalesces into something that doesn't really have an ideology, but is also constantly talked about as, quote, left-wing terrorism.
In my mind, that's fair.
Like, yeah, in my mind, that is the theme, is, like, it's this big disparate group who are mostly aligned of a common, vaguely anti-authority cause, trying, you know, they're shadowboxing something that they don't fully understand. But, like, because they do it in such a specific way outside of the bounds of the law, you know, this is a game that has military corruption, this is a game that has business corruption, and all of that's fine, all of that's legal. But because these are people who are explicitly doing something against what the law wants you to do, they are the radical left-wing terrorists who, you know, are just crazy and bombing whatever they want for no reason. Like, that works for me.
There is sort of a thing where the game, like the ICA participates in the propaganda messaging.
Yeah.
And it's definitely apparent in this level where, like, you kind of have to dig deep to figure out what they're doing and what's going on. I think it's just that, like, for a series where so much of the messaging is super on the nose, This one is weirdly nuanced, almost to make it, like, hard to parse.
Yeah.
Even if it's on purpose, it's kind of awkward. Because, like, you look at that, and then you look at, like I said, like, Bangkok, where it's, oh, Jared Leto is bad. or Marrakesh is very obvious and on the nose. And, you know, you've got a lot of these very clear targets that are playing off of tropes of the rich and powerful. And in the narrative, Colorado is a weird turning point where you're kind of working for the rich and powerful.
Yeah.
But that makes it really awkward, and they don't do a lot of this in later Hitman games.
Yeah.
They mostly stick to the targets that are, like, people in positions. This feels like punching down in a weird way.
Yeah. Like, I think...
And again, narratively, it's kind of constructed that this is you punching down.
Yeah, this was a rush job because, you know, oh, well, we have this immediate problem and the guys above told us that we have to solve it now.
Yeah.
So one thing I would like to say is we are talking about the World of Assassination version of Colorado. There are changes from Hitman 2016 to the version today that have made Colorado only better. Notably, the tall foliage, the Pokemon grass.
Yes.
Usually, in the first game, you would have to do a lot of, like, sight lines and, you know, going from cover to cover. The foliage makes it a lot less painful and a lot better of a level. So, like, just saying, like, while there is analysis and while it is, you know, worthwhile to talk about that and to bring that up on its own rights, we're talking about World of Assassination because if you purchase the game today, that's the version you're going to be playing, and it is better.
Oh, yeah. For what it's worth, the castle parapet towers in Sapienza also have this issue, where in the original version, there's a lot of tall grass that does nothing,
yeah,
but acts as concealment in the new one that's very helpful and useful. So I also wanted to note, I almost forgot to mention this when we talked about Sean Rose, but he's another character you can psychologically torture.
Yeah.
He has, like, severe OCD, and you can set off his triggers, and it makes him smoke, and you can start a gas leak next to where he smokes.
That's actually, small note, by the way, starting a gas leak next to where someone smokes is a regular kill. I swear to God, I've never fucking done it in the game once.
Yeah.
Another thing that I would add in some kind of refresh of this game, there's, like, five basic kills that you can do in every level for points, for, like, experience. I would make a sixth one and make it explosions. I understand that you can't do that Silent Assassin, but, like, there's a lot of explosions in the game, and the game wants you to play around with them, but there is, very often, there is no extrinsic thing telling you to do that.
I would remove drowning, because oftentimes the way you're drowning people is by poisoning them first and making them have to throw up.
Yeah.
But that's beside the point. So Colorado's level design is really kind of awkward because it's the first level where you are not given any public space.
Yeah.
The moment you show up, you are trespassing. This is in, like, the default mission where you're playing in the story. There are other starting points, but the ones where you start with, like, just the suit on, you're going to trespass no matter what. The level has a giant fence around it, and you start outside the fence, so you have to find a way to get through.
Yep.
You can, like, climb through it in a few spots, go behind it. If you keep going to the back of the map near the house doesn't have a fence, or has it more gaps or something. There's a big mud pool where, like, they do a training exercise or something.
There's a slurry pit where they keep the slurry. I think Zoldim noted that too.
Yeah. You know, this famous slurry. I love the slurry pit. It feels like something where, like, once a year they would do, like, a charity event to raise money for breast cancer research. If it were a regular farm. But there are patrols of guards walking around the outside, so it's very difficult to get in. And again, that's from the very start of the level, so good fucking luck. Inside, like I said, there's a few different buildings. This is notable for being a level where you can unlock a sniper rifle by doing the, like, mastery.
Yeah, and I think this is, like, the first decent silent sniper rifle you can get, too.
Yeah, and you can do that because there's this little water tower next to the garage, or on top of the garage, even, that's very easy to get to, very quick to get to, and has clear sight lines of everybody. It should be worth noting, I don't remember if we mentioned this, but they did make individual sniper levels eventually for the World of Assassination. One of them was Hitman 1 DLC and one of them was Hitman 2 DLC. But for the most part, every level has some sort of sniper nest or nests that you're kind of intended to use.
Yeah.
Some of them require a lot more setup that can't be done with pure sniping. Paris has one where you have to, like, do an event to lure Novikov out and then do another event to lure Diana or Dahlia out. Sapienza has like two or three different nests and different targets are visible from different locations.
Yeah. Like technically you can like technically get Silvio from the town square one, but only barely.
And it's harder to do it with an accident kill.
Yeah, especially.
So like this is the first time you're really able to get a good shot at everyone from there. So the normal starting position for the level also has a unique ending position, which is that secret room.
Yeah, this is another change, by the way. In 2016, apparently that was the only way you could end a level unless you're playing like an escalation.
So in later versions, I think starting in the Hitman 2 like update, they made it so that if you're not doing the
specific first story event,
then you don't have to do this, because what would happen is after you've killed everyone, Diana's like, oh hey, our experts have found that there's actually another room hidden underneath the house. Find a way to get in there, bitch.
Actually, should be noted, it's not our experts. This is something that we're doing that the ICA doesn't know about.
Oh.
This was part of what Diana says in the beginning is like, you know, we should do some snooping of our own.
Oh.
And so like part of...
She points it out.
Yeah, yeah. I think it's like you have to hear it from, you know, one of the random soldiers.
Yeah.
But like, yeah, part of the thing is that it's like we, 47, are trying to figure out things about what's going on with the conspiracy.
That's right. Look, it's been a long time since I did this story specific thing because I don't enjoy doing this part.
Yeah, but I was about to say, it's been a long time since you played Colorado because that would require playing Colorado.
There's a few ways you can get into it, but essentially there's a door that has a facial scanner, and the main thing you can do is use a 3D printer to print a mask of, I think it's just Ezra's mask, but
it's Sean's face. Yes.
It's not even Ezra's mask.
It's not even Ezra's mask.
You print
mask.
A mask of Sean's face using a 3D printer that they have. You put it on, and that lets you go into this secret safe house room, which has been partially cleared out by the time you get there.
But it still has the whole, like, you know, tack board and string and
stuff.
Much like the one in this room.
Yes. Yes. So here's where we can finally discuss the Shadow Client. On the cork board in the secret, super secret safe house room, there are pictures of 47, which for one thing is a problem. But also there's a whole bunch of notes about something called Providence, which is like the Illuminati. Cool, we got that? Okay.
Yeah.
One of the people listed in Providence as like members that are listed in these notes is Soders.
Oh my gosh.
That's what it was.
The evil guy who was doubting 47 in the beginning and also who rushed the job we just did is secretly evil?
So the reason he rushed the job is because, as it turns out, the Shadow Client is targeting Providence members.
Yeah.
That's what all of these murders were as part of it, but also, like, he got the list of people from Iago, he got the funds from Strandberg and Thomas Cross. He used those funds to arm the militia and supply his own needs for this whole thing. Also, by the way, I forgot to mention, there's another hacker girl alongside Penelope Graves. It's Olivia Hall.
Her role in the narrative is to get hacked by the ICA three separate times.
Yep. So yeah. So the Shadow Client is tracking 47, using 47 to kill Providence members and also further his own goals. And one such Providence member is Soders. So Soders is an ICA member who broke ICA's like neutrality clause, essentially.
Yeah.
Because he rushed this job in Colorado along as a way to retaliate against the Shadow Client.
Yeah.
It's not just that the Shadow Client is like abusing the ICA, but he was personally going to affect Soders at some point.
Yeah. Also, so we close out Colorado. Fairly certain we're mostly done with Colorado.
We are done with Colorado.
There's like one or two other things we could say, but like Colorado is considered the low point for a reason. But, oh, I have one last point I want to say. Every fucking person is armed, and there is no real good universal disguise. Those are the other two major ass pain points with Colorado.
I was also going to say that, similarly to, like, all the farm equipment that's dangerous, I feel like this does play into a... There's some stuff with Parvati of, like, essentially just firearm safety and fucking with, like, procedure and training and how that can lead to lethality. This is, like, the OSHA violation level for farms. OSHA violations are a big part of accident kills.
Yeah.
But in this case, it's, like, farms and gun ranges, which is very America. Good job. Thank you. Thank you, IO, famous non-American devs.
I believe that they are Danish. So...
Okay. So...
So... We get to, we have the cutscene. We actually have a cutscene where the Shadow Client, who we still don't know the name of, is looking at 47 through a sniper. He's, like, looking at us after we just did the mission and talking to Olivia Hall, who's like, God damn it, they just fucking hacked me. And he's like, don't worry about it. It's what they do. It certainly won't happen multiple more times in this narrative. And then he squeezes the trigger. And then he lets go of the trigger.
Ooh.
As 47 looks behind him. Ooh, he knows him, but how? So we move on to Hokkaido.
Yeah.
Situs inversus.
Which is a real medical condition where your organs are mirrored, more or less.
Yeah.
So it turns out Soders has situs inversus, and he has a failing heart. Not only does he need a heart transplant, he needs a right side heart transplant from a donor with situs inversus. Those are hard to come by, and it turns out the only one he can find is one that is not exactly ethically sourced.
Yeah.
Yeah, so Hokkaido takes place at a treatment facility by a company called Gamma, who does these, like, for-profit hospitals for the rich and powerful.
Yep.
And
it's like a, like, hospital slash resort where it's like, you know,
yeah,
you're waiting on your life-saving lung transplant. So you get to kick it in the spa for, you know, the next
the
few days.
The hot spring. It's a very, very Japanese hot spring place with an actual hot springs you can fuck around in.
Hokkaido, I think, is my favorite. It's either my favorite or my second favorite level of the very first game, because it is beautiful.
It is beautiful. The level split into two areas. There is the proper hospital section where there's a lot of guards and a lot of doctors, and that is where Soders is. He is on an operating table because he is being operated on by Kai, a AI created by Kronstadt Industries. It's Kronstadt AI. K-R-O-N-S-T-A-D-T is Kronstadt. Kai is this newfangled operating surgery robot AI.
Yeah.
It has like a HAL 9000 light bulb for a face, quote unquote, and has a giant server rack that you can fuck around with.
Yeah. It has a pleasing female voice, because obviously, and it flirts with the chief surgeon.
Can't you change the voice on it?
I don't remember. I don't think you can change the voice, but you can fuck with it. That is,
yeah, you
main...
can make it evil.
Yeah, you can make it fucked up and evil.
Yeah, so Soders is a frail man who is on the edge of death, so any, like, jostling will actually kill him.
Yeah.
Speedrunners, like, create an explosion near the operating theater.
Which is enough to kill him.
Yeah, which, by the way, has a giant view to the, like, interior garden, or the central courtyard garden, which is a nice garden. It's got bridges and rivers and rocks and sand, and, you know, it's very, very sort of typical Japanese garden sort of deal. But, like, yeah, it's really funny just, like, how frail he is and how easy he is to kill in that regard. You can also, like, mess with Kai. You can... There's a lot of ways you can mess with Kai.
Yeah, there's multiple individual things where, like, part of the reason that he's here is that the chief surgeon is experimenting on him with this, like, stem cell research by filtering stem cells in and out of him. You can poison a backup thing and then drain his stem cells and put in the poison one and get one of the more... One of the genuinely grosser animations of him, like, you know, leaking, basically. You can also sabotage the defibrillator and, like, cause an issue and then go up to the defibrillator room and turn it super powerful as the defibrillator goes off to just fucking electrocute him. This is, like, they learned their lesson from Sapienza and gave you a static target that has so many fun ways to kill him.
Yeah. The other target is Yuki Yamazaki, an ex-Yakuza lawyer who is currently aligned with Providence. She helped procure the heart, from what I remember. And, I mean, she works for Providence, and yeah. Providence is a piece of shit, as we've learned. So, you know, we don't want anything to do with them, right? So yeah, Yuki Yamazaki has to die. She's staying in the facility for just, like, a wellness thing.
Like, yeah, she's kind of there to, like, check on Soders and basically just to be there because it's a spa and yeah. resort.
Like, she does yoga. She hangs out in the hot springs in the sauna. You can kill her by cranking up the heat in the sauna. You can also, like, do one-on-one yoga with her in the hot springs and kill her that way.
Yeah.
Very, lots of options. Also, I'm just gonna go ahead and say that the unique costume for this level is a ninja, and you can get a sword, of course.
Yeah, it's why the really fuck not?
There's also a reference to the game Three Ninjas, which I did not realize was an IO Interactive game.
Yeah, IO Interactive is one of those devs that, like, has worked on things that you hear and you're like, no the fuck they didn't. What the fuck, they made that? See, like, Kane and Lynch or Freedom Fighters.
Yeah.
The, like, sixth gen game.
The resort area is really interesting because when you start the level, you are checked in for your own, like, wellness check. And you are given this, like, yukata or kimono or something to wear, and your outfit is your key card.
Yeah.
All the doors are electronically locked and they're tied to your outfit. So if you can get a guard's disguise, you don't have to worry about getting a guard's key to unlock the doors. But this also means that your lockpick, which is your standard tool that you'll probably have unlocked by now, doesn't work on most of the level. So it can be a bit harder to traverse the locked doors than in most levels. A lot of other things like crowbars or just shooting a lock with a strong gun also don't work.
Also, yeah, should be noted, by the way, the first time you play this, and until you have Mastery 20 in this, you don't have your loadout. You do unlock the different dead drop locations, like, as you're leveling it up, but the three slots that you begin with of a gun and two equipment pieces, you don't get that until you have, like, completed the level a number of times.
Yeah. It makes it very tricky. You're not given much by default. And, I mean, there is the thing, you can do the room service trick in this one as well.
Yeah.
That is worth noting. But yeah, you're not given a whole lot. And also, like, when you leave your room, if you can't easily climb out of your room to go somewhere else, there's a huge drop outside your balcony. So, like, you can hang on the ledge and climb to the adjacent room, which is where Amos Dexter, the cowboy, is.
Yeah, Amos Dexter, I believe, was he in Paris? Was he the senator in Paris?
I don't know.
I don't know. Who was in Paris?
Is he related to the cowboy from Absolution who goes yeehaw?
Yes, he is. Dexter, like, Blake Dexter is the cowboy from Absolution who goes fucking yeehaw.
Fucking Christmas.
And yes, Amos Dexter is therefore related to and probably a reference to him.
Yeah. Now, there's a lot of great characters that are staying at this hotel for rich assholes. The best one, the best character in the series is Jason Portman.
Yeah.
Jason Portman is like, he's like a tech bro, essentially.
Yeah, he is quintessential tech bro, but like, not even, you know, on top of the world tech bro. He is very like millennial coded on top, thinks he's on top of the world.
Nouveau riche.
Yeah.
Like, just a stupid asshole. And he is there because he's getting a full facial plastic surgery to get his face to look like Helmut Krueger.
Remember Helmut Krueger from the very first mission? Oh my god, yeah. It's so good.
It's great because when he shows up, he is in bandages because, you know, he was just operated on and he's still in recovery. And when he sees you, he's like, hey, you stole my idea.
Yeah.
What are you doing? You stole that from me.
And he follows you so you can get him to a secluded area.
Yeah. You can take his outfit, which includes his bandages, and then you can go to the hospital in a completely different voice than him. Be like, I'm Mr. Portman. I'm here to do my post-operating checkup. And the doctor takes the bandages off and he's like, this is incredible. You look like you haven't even had surgery.
Yeah, the doctor starts crying. It's like some of the best comedy in the game.
God, Jason Portman is just such a piece of shit. And like, this is one of the peak comedy moments. They take Krueger, which was already funny, a funny bit, like, oh, this supermodel looks just like 47. And they continue the joke.
Yeah, yeah. Also,
and the fact that, like, he's there to get his face to look like an existing supermodel, so much to where the other guy who looks just like the supermodel, he thinks is copying it. Like he's copying the supermodel. He doesn't have the right to this face.
Yeah.
He is, like, instead of just making himself look better, but look like himself, but better, he looks like a different guy.
Also, he's doing this to impress, like, an ex, you know, an old flame of his, Stacy, yeah. Who he, you know, he becomes a recurring character, and every time he shows up, he is calling Stacy, desperately trying to reconnect.
God.
Like, it's so good, such good characterization, such good comedy. Ugh.
God, he's so funny. Worth noting, so I mentioned the hot springs and the sauna. Another part of the fantasy that I really want to point out, other than wearing a kimono, because that's obviously part of the fantasy for the people playing this game.
Seeing 47 in a kimono is part of the fantasy for me.
Oh, hell yeah.
I agree.
So, like, there is a sushi bar, of course.
Yep.
And, of course, you can do the Yakuza thing of, oh, you make fugu sushi, but you put the wrong part of the pufferfish in that's poisonous. Like, that is such a common trope that Simpsons did it. And so, of course, they let you do it as well.
Actually, yeah. Good point to bring up, by the way. So, number one, that is almost certainly a reference to, like, obviously the fact that you can do it, like you said, is just a very fun trope. But also, that is a kill that you can do in, like, one of the Japan levels in one of the earlier games, I believe.
Because it's such a common trope.
Yeah, yeah. And, like, you might remember from the very beginning, like, cutscene, that is one of the kills you see is, you know, somebody eating a piece of sushi and then choking and dying. But also, too, this entire level is kind of a, I almost said rehash, that's way too negative. It's kind of like a spiritual successor to a California rehab center, which I believe I mentioned in the last episode as well, that, like, up to and including the fact that Agent Smith, recurring character in the series Agent Smith, is in Hokkaido, and if you find him, he references that specific place. He's like, wait, you're in that pine cone place in California. So, like, that is already a really cool thing, too, that, like, this is basically them doing, again, one of their, like, most iconic levels. Really good stuff.
The resort place, I think, feels really small every time I play, because you're intentionally limited to very little. There's a really nice tree. There's a walkway going between the resort and the hospital, and it's like the one that the guests use when it's their turn to get checked up. There's a nice tree between the two.
Yep.
A nice indoor tree. It reminds me of the whistling tree from The Witness. But the hospital area has a lot of fun little stories going on. There is, like, an employee break room. They have a capsule hotel for the employees to stay in, which, you know, another great moment of just abusing your employees and lower workers.
Yeah, there is division, too, because there's, like, the medical staff quarter and then the working class staff quarter.
Yeah, but there's a break room that has a DDR game set up.
Yeah.
And, of course, you can play it, and you're fucking great at it, because, of course, he is.
I think that's the one thing that you're not good at.
Really?
If I remember correctly, because it's a bit of an Easter egg. I don't remember exactly what you have to do.
You have to be wearing the ninja outfit.
Yeah. It's a bit of an Easter egg to actually do it. And once you do it, I think that it's the one thing where, like, he starts flopping around and doing it very poorly. This is one I'm willing to be wrong on, but I seem to remember this being pointed out that, like, of everything, this is the one thing that he's not good at.
Dude, I'm sorry for making such a bad episode. I thought I had my notes together. Man, I'm fucking up. But
this isn't a bad episode because you're here.
There's a guy in the morgue who's a creepo, and fuck that guy.
Yeah, the main morgue mortician is like, a guy who's like, oh, yes, we got the heart. It was, you know, a bit more trouble than expected. Ah, yes, if you could find me a new liver. He has a microchip in his brain because he's very bipolar. And so he, like, signed himself up for a medical trial to like give him a switch to like dose him with chemicals, to dose him with like neurological chemicals. And you can specifically give him his uppers to like get him into the room with the backup heart, with the right-sided heart that Soders wants, and then give him downers to get him out of that room.
Yeah.
Although if you don't give him uppers again, he will actually like slowly make his way over to a ledge and jump off of it.
Oh yeah.
Which is, yeah. So that's great. Like the people who are at the upper echelons of the medical staff are like kind of,
they're,
you know,
just terrible people.
Yeah. They're like, you know, sneering geniuses who are, you know, very infatuated with their thing. There are like two cameras in the area. One of them is in the public area, but one of them is actually in the morgue. And it is like one of the, this is what I love about Hokkaido. You are told at the outset of like, keys don't work here. Outfits are your keys. Works well with the game. It's a very fun, you know, like last hurrah for the game to do that. But you're also in this facility where most of it is off limits to you. And so that sounds like it's going to be a difficult thing, but as with a lot of levels in this game, there is like one very easy path where you can just get to the morgue, choke out the one guy in the basement looking at the cameras, and completely disable the cameras on the level. And I love that, that it's like, it's another, you know, fortress style level. But because, you know, if you know just like these couple of very specific paths to go through, it's one of the easiest levels to do.
Yeah. So from the garden, you can get to this walkway that kind of wraps around the outside of the building. It feels like something more out of a spy movie than anything else in a way.
Yeah.
Because it goes by like a guard break room where a few people in uniforms can be. And then there's a door from there into the morgue. The elevation of this level is just really weird because like,
yeah,
the garden is like on a hill. The resort is like a level below the hospital.
That's a good point. The public facing areas are on the lower levels.
Yeah.
And the penetrating the fortress is going up more often than not.
And then there is a starting point that is on a cliff on the very back of the level that is higher than everything else.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's a nice cliff though. There's some nice, oh, like outdoors area that are around the building, but it's very hard to get to because you have to kind of go down like three stories to reach.
Yeah.
I also wanted to, so I have weird feelings about this level, not in terms of anything the level outright does, but there is this odd mistrust of medical technology in it. And I'm kind of complicated about it because I am a diabetic, a type 1 diabetic, and I have already have mixed feelings about medical technology because of that.
Yeah.
I think this level is more about irresponsible uses of technology between the guy. Is it Hush that has the chip?
No,
Hush is from the later level.
Yeah.
No.
It's just like the, it's the mortician.
Yeah. Right? The mortician. I don't remember his name. He has that brain chip. And then Kai is very clearly a, like, a story of caution, a cautionary fable of why would you trust your body that is already frail to a machine that can be tampered with or can fail? Like, the fact alone that there is not a traditional operating theater is ultimately what does Soders in more often than not. I mean, you can tamper with the heart by going through the mortician and everything, but, like, most of it is he's vulnerable because it is not a standard operating theater with a standard surgeon and, you know, team of doctors.
Yeah.
For me, I do rely on medical technology tremendously to live, but I have also had moments where the introduction of more quote unquote modern technology has made my life harder. One example is a lot of glucose monitors and some insulin pumps require cell phone connection to work. But that introduces a point of failure where if the connection stops working for whatever reason, you suddenly can't use your pump or can't see your blood sugar.
Yeah.
That is terrifying to me because that means that a random technological mishap that could very easily be outside of someone's control could be responsible for their well-being. I feel like there is an amount of like I am a very transhumanist person and a transhumanist person, but like there is an amount of caution that you have to put into these types of things when it comes to things like brain chips or, yeah, replacements for humans in the current year.
Yeah.
With AI being in everything, replacing humans is such a, like, bad proposition when I need to interact with a human who has been trained in something properly and I can converse with, that, like, if anything, this level has aged better.
Yeah.
Especially the stuff with Kai.
I also feel like the 1-2 punch of Colorado into Hokkaido is also a big part of the theme, where it's like, you have seen how the other side of this conflict lives. You have seen how, like, they have to fashion together a base of operations out of, like, in a desiccated farmhouse and a barn and everything. Like, you have seen how people who undeniably have resources but are not the people who have resources have to fight this war. Now you get to see how the other side gets to reap all the benefits from it.
They're out here stealing organs from people.
Yeah.
That's another, like, especially Yakuza trope of, like, stealing organs from people.
Yeah.
But in this case, it's not even the Yakuza that are doing it. It's the hospital staff.
Yeah.
I just made that connection just now. You can, that's for you, the listener.
I kind of love that there is a recurring theme with various targets of, like, being ex-criminal turned quote-unquote normal, of, like, you know, ex-Yakuza, ex-Russian mobster. Like, it is a theme of, like, you know, oh, well, now that they're legal, we can't actually do anything about it.
Yeah, you know? It's very funny in that regard of, like, it feels like they are themselves just doing the same thing they've always done, just with different allegiances or with, like, a different smokescreen. It is funny, though, it implies an amount of pre-existing connection to the underworld.
Yeah.
And I think that's a big part of the game in, like, the way the stories are presented, is that, like, it is not just that these are rich assholes who are making life worse for you. It's that they're all connected with each other in different ways.
Yeah.
Whether it's indirectly or, like, they work for the same people. And if anything, over the course of the trilogy, you realize they're all literally connected and they all work for the same people. But I think that's part of the story. And it's a story that could be very dangerous if handled inappropriately. But, like, the fact that you have people from so many different nationalities helps avoid it being anti-Semitic, as a lot of global conspiracies can often end up being.
Like, yeah, I bring up the, like, racial politics of the game because I feel like it is very good. You know, I'm not going to say exceptional or anything like that, but, like, it does a very good job of, like, often showing or centering, like, how power truly often is centered of, like, you know, it's more often than not in the Imperial Corps. It's in the hands of people who are considered white. Typically, it's in the hands of men. But there are also so many shades and layers of the, like, the hierarchy just one or two steps down from the 0.01% that are, like, constantly on display, you know, as mentioned with, like, Francesca, but even, like, Yuki Akazaki is kind of an example of this, where, like, Yuki is significantly less likable of a person. She is significantly more hated, and, like, other people actively talk about how she, you know, she as a lawyer did terrible, heinous things and kind of loved it. But she is still, like, a woman at the behest of a bunch of men above her who is put in harm's way, mostly by right of just being there on the wrong day. Like, it is a game that is constantly both asking who is the kind of person who would be in this position of power, but also asking why would they be here now? And that is, in an era where it is very easy to not do that and still make a good stealth game level, ultimately elevates this game to a very, like, lovely place.
I do think it will reach a crescendo in terms of the political allegory in the second game.
Yes.
I think that is the one that is the most potent in terms of its commentary, but we do not have time because we've almost talked for 3 hours and I have to edit this son of a bitch.
So to close the book on this, the last cutscene we see is we've struck back at Providence. We've told Providence, hey, fuck you. We're a neutral organization. Well, this random nameless old fucking white guy walks up to Diana and is like, I see that you made your choice. And she's like, yes, ICA is neutral. And he's like, well, you say that. And then he pulls out a picture of 47 as a child. And then he hands it over and Diana looks at the camera and goes, oh God, we're going to have to follow up on this in Hitman 2. And, cut to credits. So that is the final cutscene and thus the breadth of the story that we will get into for the first game of Hitman 2016 within the Hitman World of Assassination trilogy. Final wrapped up thoughts.
I think there's so many parts of Hitman 1, as in 2016, are like kind of awkward to go back to, but also still very enjoyable. And I think there aren't any levels that are completely unsalvageable. I mean, again, it's in my top five favorite games of all time, but like, even just taking the Hitman 1 levels in Hitman 1, there are things like the Aether Virus or the exit from Colorado or the level of Colorado that are like, they're not as fun to replay, but they still do have a lot of merit, whether it be as gameplay or in other means. And like, we've only scratched the surface when it comes to things like challenges, opportunities, level design, like tricks going on in the game, story beats and characters. And like, that's part of what makes it appealing to me is the world part of it.
We mentioned mission stories because they are often the things that the player is kind of like most immediately presented with, most immediately sort of like put into that, those sorts of places. But more often than not, even outside of mission stories, there are so many ways to like change targets' pathing or, you know, get them to react in certain ways to certain stimuli, even to like partially do mission stories, but in a way that's like, you know, if part of the mission story is, oh, knock this guy out and put on a disguise. A lot of them are, you don't even have to knock the guy out. You can just poison the food or, you know, do the thing and then get the guy to do his job.
I totally forgot to mention that one of the ways you can kill Yuki is, so there's a cable car that connects the facility to the actual like town. And when she goes into lockdown, she runs to the cable car to evacuate, which will lose you the level if you let her do so. But it gives you a great opportunity to fuck with her.
You can shoot the cable car railing.
Yeah.
And if she has gotten on it, it will fall and she will die.
Yep.
It's also funny to note, though, that if you don't do that, that is one of the valid exits for you. You can just walk through the front door. You checked in, obviously. Yeah, I feel like the overall thesis that I have for this game and for the game as a whole is that A, Hitman has a wonderful, like, beyond just being a game, Hitman has a very fun story that is also deeply interesting and more often than not tells a lot of the themes through the gameplay. B, while it's no replacement for theory, entertainment that teaches you good politic is a pretty important thing in today's media ecosystem. And so C, the fact that the Hitman series, which, as I mentioned in the first episode, is the kind of thing that a lot of the earlier games you could look at and kind of call schlocky nowadays for how a little bit exploitative and a little bit, you know, silly that they are. The fact that this is the series that like refined all of that to a razor's edge to make like incredible political points, to like inspire a lot of interesting thoughts, and even just to like give you a good stealth game level all around it where you get to kill Ezra Klein and Elon Musk over and over again.
Ezra Klein?
Like,
you want to run that back?
Nah, I'll keep it there. For legal reasons, we don't want to kill Ezra Klein. Ezra Klein is Ezra Fine. I would not Ezra Wine or Ezra Dine him.
But okay, come on.
So, yeah, the fact that this is the series that has like kind of coalesced all of this together into such a beautiful package is sort of amazing. especially when you get to IOI's individual story and, you know, the fact that, like, this was a weird experiment that they then had to break off from Square about. Like, that is also incredible, and I love IOI, and I wish them nothing but the best. I did play, like, a couple of hours of 007 First Light before doing this, just to sort of see, and yeah, it's fucking good already.
No spoilers, I haven't played it yet.
No spoilers, but, like...
I still gotta finish Deltarune Chapter 5, and then I gotta play Mina the Hollower, and then I can get to First Light.
And don't forget to do Tomodachi Life in between.
Dude, there's too many video games.
Too many video games.
Too many fucking video games, man. I gotta say, like, every time I talk about this game, my brain wants to do this, like, balanced, measured, like, pros and cons and all that, but, like I said, it's one of my favorite games as a whole, and really just a fantastic work in every part of it. Like, every small gripe I have is ultimately overshadowed by the sheer quantity of the package, and don't, I know what I said, but look, I do agree with the whole thing about, like, entertainment that teaches you good politic and all that, and that's why I propose that we make a new genre name for any game that has sort of vaguely left-wing, left-of-center politics. I think, named after the book The Conquest of Bread, we should call it Breadio Games. all right. Thank you for listening. Sorry this one's longer. I'm apologizing to myself.
Yeah.
Because, again, I have to edit this. You can find us on any podcasting platform you like. Give us a like, give us a rating, give us a review. Let us know how we're doing. Let us know what all we got wrong, because there's so much in this game. And let us know what you'd want to hear us cover next, or just things you think we might like. Oh, you can follow us on Blue Sky at netsurferpro.bsky.social, where you can get teasers for upcoming episodes in the form of little emojis. I tried to put bald guy with gun, and it looked like the bald guy was aiming the gun at his head.
Oh, no.
And I was like, wait, no. But so you can see fuck ups like that on there. You can follow me on Blue Sky at twack.bsky.social, twak.bsky.social. You can also find me on twitch.tv/twack, which is where I've been streaming those games like Deltarune, Mina the Hollower, and at some point James Bond First Light, and as well as like Pokemon Champions, Tactical Nexus, Tomodachi Life. Whole bunch of nonsense.
Wide variety.
If you have missed those and you want to find them, you can find me on YouTube. You can find me on YouTube at Twack, but also my VOD channel is Twack's Vods and Ends. VODS and Ends.
Which is a very good name.
Thank you.
You can find me at Blue Sky at galenwilson.bsky.social. I believe that's at galenwilson.bsky.social. I post my hot takes and, you know, opinions about various video games. You can find me on YouTube at The Only Galen on YouTube, where I'm sure I'll post a video one of these days. This will be very handy when I eventually do start posting videos, that I keep saying this YouTube channel that as of right this second has no videos. And you can find me on, I think, Tumblr at galenwilson.tumblr, however Tumblr URLs are. Tumblr was weird. I'm trying to put, like, kind of long-form political rants onto Tumblr, but I might need to just turn it into the place where I talk about video games that we don't talk about here. I have at least one rant about, like, Cyberpunk 2077 and Game Dev Tycoon on there, so check that out if you want. Follow me there to tell me that I should write more.
And you can follow me, or just find me, I guess, at Arrowwood Island. I don't have an address there, it's not part of the postal system, so don't try to mail me anything. But, they've got the Miss Peacock from Clue.
Oh my god.
You know, that's something.
Can you give me an autograph next time you're around?
No.
Okay.
They don't sell those there. But, you know, what's interesting is there was a murder there.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
That's interesting. Does that have anything to do with your boyfriend who kills people?
Not that I know of.
Hmm.
I don't think he's gotten any... You know, the person that died isn't really a big billionaire or anything. He was like a gym coach or something. Well, I don't actually know what he did. He's supposedly a coach, but that might just have been his name.
Yeah. Oh, speaking of nothing that you've just said, actually. Okay. I believe I'm hearing the doorbell, actually. Let me just... Maybe this is maybe this is your boyfriend, or maybe it's the intern.
My husband, thank you.
Oh, yeah, married. Sorry, husband, of course. Scree. Oh, it's not even. It's the delivery guy.